Did you both go to Cala?
Yeah,
we did. I was talking today about how there's no standardized pronunciation.
Oh, Cala, Cal-A.
I kept saying Comic Arts LA all weekend, just out of like insecurity.
So you couldn't possibly mispronounce anything?
Right.
I had not tried it until just a second, but yeah, insecurity is the right word, because I was like, Cala? like you went to the gala?
Yeah,
I'm trying to remember what Jen and Angie said. I think it was Cala.
Okay.
Because like the A in arts is like an ass R A sound. Kayla? No, that doesn't work at all. Sorry.
That never occurred to me to do that with acronyms.
I think that everyone should just go with whatever sounds right to them.
Welcome to TCJ Talkies, the podcast paid for by the Comics Journal and hosted by me, Mike Dawson. I'm a cartoonist. You can check out my work, my website, mikedawsoncomics.com. Follow me on Twitter and Tumblr. This is the podcast where cartoonists come on to chat about books that we've read, like a book club. In this episode, I'm pleased to welcome Sam Alden and Sophia Fosta Dimeno into the Talkie Hut. We're going to talk about two comics by the cartoonist who is known only as Gigi, the letter Gigi. Sam Alden is a cartoonist and illustrator living in Los Angeles. I had the same problem with Alden is the Cala. It's my New Jersey accent. Anyway, Sam Alden is a cartoonist and illustrator living in Los Angeles. He is the author of It Never Happened Again and the upcoming New Construction, both published by Uncivilized Books, soon to be my alma mater, and Storyboards for Adventure Time. He's won 2 Ignatz Awards. Sophia Fosta Dimeno is also a cartoonist and illustrator. She lives in San Francisco. She was the winner of 3 Ignatz Awards for her comics, Sphincter and Sex Fantasy. And she's been serializing a webcomic called Swim Through Fire online, which is written by former guest of the show, Annie Mock, which I recommend checking out. Prior to me reaching out to Sam and Sophia to talk, come on an episode, I didn't know anything about the comics of Gigi, but I've since learned that she's published a number of short stories online. They can all be read at her website, which is ogg.com, but I think I kind of need to link to it because it's spelled out a little differently than it sounds. But I really love her comics, and I was grateful for the suggestion, and so we're going to go straight into the conversation. So, how did you guys come across the work of Gigi?
At the time I first found her work, I think that she was, like, sort of exclusively an online presence. I did meet her at TCAF last year, but her, like, entire output is really tailored for the internet, and, something that's true even of her work in print is that, like, it's formatted with this, like, vertical flip book, I guess.
Yeah.
Which kind of evokes the feeling of scrolling through a web page. And her site is so impeccably curated. A lot of her work was serialized on the Comics Workbook, so it is sort of, like, bred for the online experience, and the themes in her work reflect that. Like living in a world with increasing, like, exclusively online interaction, if that makes sense. I guess coming into her work that way was, like, really powerful because her output was designed to be experienced that way.
Okay.
Unlike the work of other artists who, you know, you first see their stuff as a print comic or you, like, trade scenes with someone and it's, like, a physical experience. Her stuff is more, like, ethereal and incorporeal, I guess.
Yeah. And you are right that her comics feel so so suited to the internet. The dialogue and the way that the story plays out is you know, so often through text messages or things that a protagonist's reading on a screen, and it's incorporated really seamlessly into the narrative. It's more natural than speech. It's just like thought or something.
Yeah. I was noticing that today when I was rereading all of her stuff, that dialogue is not frequent, and when it is, it's kind of formatted as if it's like subtitles in a movie, like a movie spoken in a foreign language or a silent film. And most of the communication is like text messages, emails from coworkers, or in one case, even like a note someone left on the door. And since so much of her work is kind of about like isolation and emotional distance, it really like drives that home. Some people's work I would describe as like warm and engaged and very like in the moment and examining the dynamics of a conversation. And her work is just like really honing in on this feeling of being separated from a community, and like this feeling of it taking an immense effort to reach anyone and communicate with anyone. It's a theme that's emerged more and more throughout her work, which is all serialized on her website, by the way. If people don't know her stuff, she has this like beautiful website that just archives everything that she has done. So you can see the progress that she's made in the past several years.
So the two comics we're specifically talking about is this one called Unattainable, mm-hmm. and A Mysterious Process. And I think you're 100% yeah. right about, like, I wasn't familiar with her work at all, but definitely in these two comics, this idea, this feeling of being isolated, like throughout, and like definitely the issue of communicating, especially in the Unattainable story, which is, I think maybe we should just try and describe it a little bit, like what the story's about.
Yeah. I feel like I'm talking a lot, Sam. Do you want to like,
Sure. I have it right. And we're starting with The Mysterious Process.
We can start with either. I mean, yeah, which.
Yeah, I also have both in front of me, so, like, yeah, we can talk about either.
Okay. Yeah, well, just in terms of, you know, what you'd call narrative, I guess, in it's a comic about a woman who leaves her apartment and walks to see a movie, and everybody that she meets has some sort of injury. They're covered in bandages or they have a splint or something, and then at the movie theater she has a conversation with a guy in the audience about change and stasis, and how she gets very emotional about movies that were filmed far enough in the past that she knows it'll never be like that again, and he gives her the name of a barber. And she goes to this barber and gets a haircut, and then her hair comes to life, and
you know,
and yeah, you know, and is this sort of black hairy woman, and it says, well, we have to fight now, and they have a fight, and she gets injured, and by the end of the story, she has a bandage of her own, and she's changed. She's successfully faced pain and changed through it.
Is that how you sort of saw the ending?
Yeah, I guess I'm segueing into my own analysis. But yeah, for me at least, I read the story and I felt that it was about the kind of stasis that you get into when you are so afraid of pain that you... you want to hold on to the past and hold on to the present, also your own present, and make superficial changes like a haircut. There's this motif of the moon, which I don't know. I probably could go deeper on that, but I felt like the moon was there as a reminder of this. This thing that is always changing and disappearing and coming back, but I don't know, there's a constant in that.
Yeah, the moon, like so it's not that long of a comic. It's only about, what's about 20 pages or a little bit longer?
I think it's 30 pages. Yeah, I've got page numbers on mine. Yeah, 31 pages.
And what there is like, it's like a,
it's a waning moon, right? What does the man say? He says the moon's in its last quarter.
Yeah, and it's a good time for a haircut for that reason.
Oh, I forgot about that.
But yeah, you like the moon sort of introduces a lot of the settings. I was sort of noticing at the beginning, like there's a moon in these sort of cascading vertical panels that sort of that establishes her inside her apartment, and then it moves to outside and the moon cascades down, and we see ourselves at a theater marquee. I hadn't thought about like sort of the change of the moon, but that's true. Do you feel like if all the people that she sees, it's not a very like heavily populated environment. It's very sort of like empty of people, except for these occasional, I guess, people who have like some kind of injury or wound on their face, or their bodies. You think that they then are like people who have faced a pain, or?
I won't directly answer your question. Sorry, I'm going to take it in a different direction, maybe. But I like the idea that in the system that she's established here, people's ability to cope with change is like visually obvious to others. So the people who have scars and wounds and bandaged body parts have faced their demons or whatever and kind of wear those injuries as a badge of pride, and they can identify that because she is unscathed, she still has this baggage that she hasn't really coped with. I think that kind of reflects, you know, Gigi has this like identification with isolated vulnerable people who maybe feel like their issues are obvious to other people. You know, if you are a withdrawn person, when you venture out into the world, you do feel like your insecurities are kind of on display, and that everyone can tell that you like haven't dealt with your shit yet. And so the sort of bandaged people, and then her sort of unscathedness kind of heightens her vulnerability in comparison to them, because everything that she's afraid of is obvious to everyone that she meets.
It's true, though, because, like, yeah, you're right. Like, all the people who have these visible, like, wounds and then bandages, they all look happy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they look happy kind of in a sinister way, though. It's very, like, Lynchian in that these characters are, like, disturbing but also friendly, but maybe, you know, uncomfortably friendly. There's a lot of just blurred boundaries. This woman that she buys her movie ticket from. Yeah, everyone is sort of superficially very nice, but it can sort of come off in a bit of a patronizing way. Again, like, if you're coming from a place of, like, vulnerability and hurt, I guess the people who seem to have moved on are threatening in a way, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Do you feel like... Go ahead, Sam.
No, go for it.
I was going to ask, like, you sort of said that in relation to Gigi as a person, or you're just sort of more taking that, like, as your kind of reading of the story?
Oh, I just mean, like, the taste that she's expressed in the way that she builds her narratives shows, like, a very nuanced understanding of, like, the isolated persona, I guess, and yeah. She's exploring it from all kinds of different angles. Our most recent one called I'm Crazy, or I guess it's not the most recent, but one of the ones she's done in 2015 is sort of all about sanity and being labeled as crazy, and then unattainable is like isolation in the workplace. So there's many different levels going on. There's also like, let's see, what's the name? Semi-Vivi, which was from 2014, is kind of this, like, arrested development woman in her 30s who, like, is unsure about her living situation and kind of not dealing with her life in any way and not relating to her friends or family. Similar themes, but, like, really different angles on the same basic concept.
Do they all sort of, like, is this a common thing, this sort of featuring this, like, single, like, like female character, like sort of at the center.
Yeah, and something else I wanted to bring up before I forget is like A Mysterious Process specifically has like this this dialogue about old films, which is really punctuated by the fact that all the dialogue is framed like subtitles. And also, I do want to emphasize the fact that like the way this comic is physically formatted, it's like portrait oriented pages, but in a vertical flipbook, and all of the panels are landscape format. So it's not broken up horizontally. It's just like, yeah, like a cascade of occasionally long, but mostly sort of like narrow panels that evoke like jump cuts in a film when they're very frequent, and then like long shots when they're very, you know, when they're taking up the whole page. And she, you know, plays with the sort of cinematic nature by sometimes showing like scenes from the same angle, and then people move, and you kind of almost feel like it's, you know, like a film reel that you're just sort of scrolling through and seeing like the figures animate as you go through it. I believe it's safe to say that she's like a big fan of like French Nouvelle Vague and that general kind of like stylishness. The character at the end of the story gets this kind of like pixie haircut, kind of like the main character in Breathless. And it's just like very stylish and impressive overall. Like all of her work is just like so impeccably stylized. But I think she also probably relates to, the kind of like emotional content of those films, which I'm not super fluent with like French New Wave, but there's definitely, you know, stuff about isolation and like women struggling with agency and feeling helpless against the world and stuff like that.
Yeah, they always end, all of her stories end in some moment of either really explicit or like coded violence, in an attempt to escape. You know, she's always, it's either like violence against herself or something representing herself, like a hair woman or something.
Yeah, there's this like really suffocating, excruciating tension that's conveyed in all these like really beautifully composed panels that just sort of builds to a breaking point and then completely goes off the rails. The her sense of design is just so precise, and everything is so perfectly balanced, and her black and white work is like the control of contrast is just like completely incredible. It really gives you the feeling of like a noir thriller where you're like in the palm of her hand experiencing all of this suppressed emotion that sort of breaks through at the end.
Yeah.
It's amazing to see, I was just gonna say, it's amazing to see, you know, because comics are always sort of pulling from different mediums because I think it's a strength of the medium, but it's amazing to see something that does draw so obviously from, you know, from film and specifically from live action film, but also feels so designed, you know. It feels more designed even than it feels more like design than cinematography. Some of the scenes. I don't know. I feel like I often think of those as as incompatible influences, or at least like visual influences with a lot of tension, because you know, cinema and film is so kinetic, and design is so, not that it has to be, but when I think of design, I think of an image that sort of is contained and sits and is dynamic within those bounds. And, it's really impressive to me that she's able to straddle both those.
Yeah. I think you're really right about like, the vertical scroll, like with the lack of like space between the panels, like they're so sort of pushed up against each other. Like the cascading is really like the way to describe it. And that's, I guess that really does sort of like give it that cinematic feel. I'm sort of looking at the end here, because you sort of talk about how it ends, Sam. Like it does end with her being violent to herself, right? She's basically cut her own forehead and wrist and ankle. But I do like how, like, it's interesting how that very last panel is sort of a close up of her eyes and sort of her eyebrows arched, like looking sort of directly at us. Like, I don't know. To me, it read as sort of like a decisive kind of thing.
Yeah, I would say this is one of the more redemptive comics that she's made. Some of the other ones end on a much bleaker note with, like, no hope or, you know, ambiguous hope, or, like, the protagonist, like, quits the oppressive system at the cost of her own, you know, life. Or, you know, there's just some sort of, like existential rebellion, but no practical rebellion, if that makes sense. But this one, it does seem like she has actually, like, she's made the change and faced reality, and has redeemed herself in a more obvious way than some of the other stories.
You know what that reminded me of is her stories are always so, there's like no fat on them, you know. There's
everything is so precise.
I'm so impressed. But I really, one little twist I really liked in Semi Vivi was that it begins with her watching a YouTube video on starting fires.
Yeah.
And it's like a survival video tip, and survival is like the sort of the one thing she's struggling with so much in that story. And then at the end she uses the technique to destroy all her possessions and this sort of rebellion against
I was reading this story quite closely today. I'm just paging through it right now.
You're talking about this other story, or
sorry, we keep jumping around. I have a huge text document open where I just took notes on all her stories.
Same, except it's my sketchbook. But yeah, the Semi-Vivi kind of is comparable to Mysterious Process in that it's sort of like violence as a mechanism for change, or destruction as the path to like a positive move in your life. The protagonist at the end of Semi-Vivi burns all of her possessions, and it kind of ends on like a similar note as a Mysterious Process, in that she just has this sort of like you know, expression of grim satisfaction with what she's like managed to do with her life.
Yeah.
What do you guys think about like, how is this pencil, you think, this Mysterious
Process? I think it's all digital, I'm pretty sure.
Is it digital?
I believe so. I think that she uses like Conti brushes, and you know, a lot of the straight lines look like they were, you know, done in Photoshop just super precisely. If it's pencil, I'll be shocked that she like measured everything out by hand. But as far as I know, based on like her Instagram, I think it's digital.
So I was gonna ask, like, she's also, so the paper quality, it's not newsprint, right? It's sort of but it's not like slick at all.
Yeah, it's pretty rough, and there's so much darkness in the story, but it never gets like completely glossily opaque. There's always this kind of like grain to it.
Yeah.
I don't know if this was risograph printed or not, but the grain sort of evokes this like, you know, crackly film quality that's already sort of present in
I think the grain is like, and I didn't think about like it being digital, but like how some of these pages, there's a lot of black on them.
Mm-hmm.
And all you're seeing is like a little bit of white, like sort of to indicate like where her hair is, or like this, I'm looking at this one page with the frog where there's like a street around her.
Yeah, and shortly after that sequence, she's like entering the barber shop and she's wearing black pants, but she's framed against the doorway and there's just sort of like no outline to the lower part of her body. It's because it's black against black. So there's lots of nice visual stuff like that. With figures being like subsumed into the darkness and then emerging into the light and having their features like blown out in high contrast.
I think, again, this just never occurred to me that that's sort of a good way to draw this kind of like black on black in the some instances where she's like sort of putting an outline around stuff. If you're doing that digitally, you get that sort of very faint, like kind of white, like grainy line.
Yeah, she does that in a few places.
That's neat.
Well, it's amazing to look at all of her work on her site because you can.
Does it have the same kind of feel, or is it more slick like this particular story?
She started out with like much rougher sort of graphite looking work, and then she really has like just sort of gone down this rabbit hole of these like very stark, inky, dark stories. Although Unattainable is more like she kind of plays up the do you want to like segue into talking about Unattainable? Okay.
Sure.
Quick overview. Unattainable is similarly in like a vertical flipbook format, but with square format pages. And the narrative is about a woman in a workplace, and all of her interactions with her supervisors are digital. Like they appear in the form of text messages and emails. And it's this sort of dystopic, really isolated nightmare bureaucracy. I'll get a little more into detail later, but I would say that the visual styling is a lot less rough compared to A Mysterious Process. Like A Mysterious Process is sort of like charcoal-y, ghost-like images, and Unattainable is a little more solid and slick, and the blacks are like completely flat and glossy, and it really evokes there's a smartphone in the story, which is like her way of communicating with her bosses and with other people, and the sort of like completely flat glossy black that occupies a lot of the pages is sort of like the reflective screen of a smartphone.
Mm-hmm.
And like all the Gigi protagonists, she has like jet black hair that kind of stands out against these like bleak, empty backgrounds.
Yeah, the smartphone, like, so she's got this like digital assistant thing. Like, it has no like, there's no case on it or anything like that. It's not.
Yeah.
It's, like, it's sort of a very sort of like it doesn't seem to reflect light. It's kind of like a black cute like rectangle.
Yeah. There's a British sci-fi show called Black Mirror, or is it called Black Mirror? Has someone heard? Okay, I only watched it once, but there are certain episodes of that actually evoke this particular story a little bit. Just like a dystopia for the modern era, like where smartphone technology is incorporated, and sort of playing up the idea of like people being enclosed in their own bubbles and not communicating with each other, not understanding the interactions they have with each other, not understanding their place in the workspace in relation to their coworkers, just being in this like nightmare of personal space. Mm-hmm. And the story is kind of about, you know, it culminates in her accidentally brushing the hand of a coworker during lunch and getting really stressed out about it. And then later her sort of her access to this like digital relaxation experience is revoked and she has to report to her supervisor who says you've basically that whoever's hand she touched in the cafeteria has like accused her of sexual assault and she has to be demoted basically or lose her job.
Yeah.
And all of this happens with like no communication between any of the players. It's just like instructions relayed to her on its black screen. And even though she passes through spaces with other people, throughout the story, she's completely alone and unable to talk to anyone.
Yeah. There's a couple like panels where like there's more people in it, but they're all looking at their own digital, like their faces are half cut off, their heads are mm-hmm. sort of like out of frame. They're just looking at their digital assistants.
And her job in this world is to categorize. She looks at photos of human emotion and categorizes them.
Yeah.
I got a lot of Black Mirror from this episode too.
Just this sort of like world in which her only role is to provide like the only thing that can't be automated, I guess.
So the job, like it starts off and she's given a task and mm-hmm. she's got like 6,000 stock photos to categorize. So photos come up and they're like people, happy people look with a cat or someone looks like they're shouting. And then there's a picture. You can't actually quite tell maybe what the emotion is. And her job is to like punch an emoticon kind of thing, like just sort of like identify as happy, sad, neutral, So like it's very much like she's having to simplify like complex, like looking emotions. And then later on when she's having to talk to her supervisor and she has to, and you know, to account for like this complaint, essentially she can only answer with like a yes or no button, like these little buttons. So like, you know, there's no complexity.
Yeah, no... it implies a world where there's like no nuance and no space to actually talk about issues, but everything is sort of this like black and white, only one right answer, only one interpretation, no compromise, no sympathy or empathy, just sort of absolute decision making.
How do you guys interpret the ending of this one? Do we know exactly what she chooses? She has to choose whether or not to be demoted or whether or not to be terminated. What do you think, Sam?
What do I think? I don't know. I kind of didn't... I think they both seemed in this world like equally nightmarish.
Yeah.
Although... I guess at the end, so she leaves this room where she's had to take this, she's had to answer this questionnaire and choose what her future was going to be, and she walks out and she sees these mountains outside the window, which is the first time you've seen anything anything that wasn't man-made or a person, and then it turns out to just be a TV screen. And it's... there's like an advertisement for some drugs.
Like scrolling across the bottom says this program of the mountain brought to you by ask your doctor about.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't think I focused as much on what that choice is. It seems like she's stuck in this world no matter what. And then at the end, the bricks of... well, I guess it's not even the bricks of the wall behind her. It's this really clever graphic thing where it's showing an elevator closing in this three-tier page. But because of because she's drawing the panel thickness exactly the same as she's drawing the lines delineating the edges of the elevator, she sort of becomes the grid, and it becomes this brick closing. Closing her in, even though it's also like a very very like a concrete thing being represented sensibly in comics.
Yeah, it does look like it could duly be interpreted as like elevator doors closing, or just like a very unorthodox panel structure where it's just sort of empty space taking over the page.
Yeah.
It's funny to compare this story with I'm Crazy, which is also about being stuck in some kind of horrific workplace that's some kind of like late capitalist nightmare. In that one, well, I don't want to jump around too much.
You can jump around?
Yeah,
Yeah, because you said you read that one recently too, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I basically read everything on her website.
Yeah, same. Yeah, in that one, she's out in the middle of the desert, and the only water to drink makes you like compliant and dim. And so she, this is another sort of little film homage. I think it may also just be that she happens to know about, I don't know, finding potable water in the desert. But she uses the same trick that the characters in Woman of the Dunes use to find fresh water in their own sort of existential crisis. Have you seen Woman of the Dunes?
I haven't.
It has a lot of analogs to I guess both these, actually to a lot of her work, there's like similar themes of isolation. And I don't want to spoil that movie for you if you haven't seen it.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
It's an amazing, it's a killer premise.
Cool.
Anyway, I'm crazy. She's you don't start with her in the facility. She talks about what she did to get there. That there was, it was some sort of maybe suicide attempt, but it's a little more magical realist. She like lies down and is found 2 weeks later in a trance-like state. And is told that she's crazy and that she has to go work in this facility out in the desert.
I love the introductory paragraph where the protagonist says, "The book they found me with, along with my preference for wearing all black, raised some red flags."
Yeah, she's so funny. She's funnier than I think we've been talking about.
No, yeah, of course, yeah. I should say that these stories are dark, but they're incredibly self-aware and usually very wry and witty.
Well, just the ending of A Mysterious Process, where this hare comes to life and says we must fight to the death.
Yeah.
I mean, like, that's funny, right?
Mm-hmm.
like it seemed, I don't know if it's like a, like it although it sort of also was a little jarring, that seemed very funny, like sort of, but anyway, not to derail, go back with what you're saying, Sam.
Oh, I might have lost my train of thought. I just wanted to talk about how much I liked I'm Crazy. it had this really beautiful, like, symmetry of narrative, and you saw the protagonist struggling against this world in successful and unsuccessful ways. Oh, and there was a smartphone in that, too. It's all about she's assembling smartphones all day.
Oh, yeah.
Or something like smartphones, these sort of black boxes you never actually see functioning.
So you said right in the beginning, we were sort of introducing that, you know, Gigi is a cartoonist, that her work exists very much online, and you sort of feel it's a product of that. But you also read a lot of sort of anxiety about, like, this sort of digital communication, like, through, like, it's like a theme.
Yeah,
like throughout all her work.
I mean, her online persona dovetails into her work so well. It's, you know, hard to say whether she did that all intentionally or whether that's just how it is because she's the way that she is and her work is the way that it is because of who she is as a person.
Well, I guess I started a question about that because I don't know that much about her, and I thought, I got the impression that's kind of by design.
Yeah, I think so too. And again, I don't know if it's intentional, but this whole sort of like really powerful experience of like stumbling on her website, having her personal info be so scarce, the presentation being so like not cold, but like very pristine and calculated, and then all of these stories about like intense distance between human beings, like it all just really makes sense as a complete experience. And it's incredibly effective.
Yeah. I'm always surprised that that more people aren't talking about her. I mean,
yeah, I know she's kind of like a cult figure. Oh, I did want to shout out at some point, and now is a good opportunity, this podcast called We Should Be Friends.
Yeah.
Run by Jacob Canfield and a whole bunch of other cool people. And they talked about Gigi's work a little bit. So if listeners want to hear more people talk about her work, that's a good one to check out. And they sort of go into a little bit more depth about like her mysterious, you know, persona.
Hmm.
I do listen to that podcast, although I don't remember that part because I was sort of curious about like the, and shout out to Jacob Canfield if he's listening. I do enjoy the podcast.
Hey, Jacob.
It just was curious to me because so I feel like sort of an online personality and like a presentation of yourself and sort of a revealing part of yourself to the internet like seems to be like so natural for cartoonists that like it seems so curious to me that like how like limited it felt.
Yeah.
Like I don't know her full name. I don't know anything about her. I'm just assuming she's from Canada. And you know, I guess I could have done a little bit more research, but like, she's not really like in, I don't think there's much out there, right? Like to research. It's just, and I like it. I like how you're sort of saying it. Like, it sort of all kind of goes together. And wouldn't it be nice if we're all that way?
Well, I think that a lot of her work is sort of about, you know, navigating how to control how others interpret your identity, you know, in a world where, like, opening yourself up basically leaves you vulnerable to, like, misinterpretation and right. manipulation or abuse in the worst cases. And this designed experience or this isolated experience is, like, a backlash against that, you know, especially, you know, in a world where, as you said, people are more likely to be overly open on the internet and want to, like, share everything about themselves, which can feel cathartic but can blow up in your face really easily. This idea of, like, rebelling against that and like retaining at all costs ownership of the way you come across, which I think comes through in her work, this idea that, like, by fighting tooth and nail, you can find a stable identity that you can defend from anyone else.
Yeah. I notice also that, you know, there are... I feel like that moment where she touches the her coworker's finger in Unattainable isn't... In some ways, I mean, the way that I initially read that scene was as kind of the first one of the few really emotional, like, interpersonal moments in her comics. She runs away and she has this reaction that if you don't really know the context of this world yet, you think is maybe some sort of... And maybe it is some sort of really emotional reaction to touching another human, which is, you know, you would guess from this world that like poops out fruit from like plastic soft serve machines.
Yeah, that was another humor.
Is rare. Yeah, that was so funny. I was so impressed with that. But I was going to say, for, you know, I think for one of the things that that these comics are so good at in portraying what it's like to be a really isolated person by design or accident is, you know, as much as the horrors of the world are that isolation, a lot of the really redemptive I guess most, not joyful moments, but the moments in which the protagonist seems to be in the most control of her life are also alone, but like alone on her own terms.
Yeah, that's a big deal.
Like lying in the desert, or watching the moon wane.
You saying it's a big deal to be sort of alone on your own terms?
I guess what I'm saying is something that rung true to me in how she depicts loneliness is that it's both a thing you fear and a thing you derive incredible joy from.
Yeah. No, I get that too. I don't get to spend much time alone. So I'm very
is that
envious.
True? Why is that?
Why do I not spend that much time alone?
Yeah.
Well, I work from home, but I'm married. I have two kids. And there's people in the house who help with the kids, and it's just like people in the house constantly. I've been in the last year going to these sensory deprivation tanks.
Wow.
What is that like?
You guys have never done that?
I've never just seen it in movies.
It's like a pod.
Mm-hmm.
It's got like this, like very. It's got salt water in it, but it's like very highly dense salt water. So you would lay back in it, you float, and it's at body temperature. So you close the door of the pod, so it's all black and silent in there, and you're floating. And the idea is, eventually, your body's supposed to sort of not even really feel the water anymore because its body, it's, you know, the same temperature as you, and you hang out in there for like an hour and a half.
That's amazing! Wow, so
how
intense.
Was it? how was it for you? Did you feel yourself disassociating from your body?
Yeah, I love it. I've been like only in the last year or two, I've been going like a couple times a year. I went before Mocha once just to get all anxious before I go to shows, and it got me feeling all mellow.
Like, that's such a good idea.
Like, all right, I'm ready to face the comics community.
That's interesting.
They must have, they're definitely going to have those things out there on the West Coast.
I'll have to check it out.
Everyone should go into the pod.
Yeah,
but it's just what you're saying, like, you're sort of like alone by design. Like, I'm spending a little bit of money to go float in a pod for an hour and a half, but it means a lot to me. Like, I really like that. Like, sort of, because you sort of, when your brain isn't feeling anything, you sort of go, you know, it will sort of disconnect a bit and all that stuff. Anyway, I'm glad I could interest you guys.
I would say, yeah, I was interested. I mean, I've known about those, but I've never known anybody who's done them, especially more than once. You know, who does them enough that it's like an actual therapeutic practice. That's really interesting.
Yeah, I went to a friend of mine had a bachelor party, and we all met in Denver to go to this bachelor party. And I said, "Hey, we should go to these pods because I really like to do it." And so my friends begrudgingly went along with it. And if you're not suited for that kind of thing, you will not enjoy it because for them it was more like a prison or being put in a tomb for, you know, an hour and a half. You know, so it's not for everybody. Anyway, I didn't mean that. Was a total derailment. I'm sorry.
No. It's extremely relevant to the content of her work,
yeah,
actually.
Completely. Yeah.
I was just looking at this really short comic she also has on her website called Inside, which, as far as I can tell, is about a woman who just stays in her apartment and observes people from the window and takes all of her groceries by delivery. So similar to being in a sensory deprivation pod.
Yeah. It's funny how, even though, you know, I do think her anonymity, for whether or not it's intentional, it is something I'm aware of when I'm reading her stories. It's funny how even with that, I feel as if, just from the consistency of her work, I maybe being a, you know, us being cartoonists, we sort of know the kind of time and practice that has to go into making this much good work. I feel like I know her. I feel like I know a lot of stuff about her.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And how she lives and the things she enjoys.
Yeah, that's why, you know, it's funny to describe her as being an incredibly private person who doesn't, you know, overshare on Twitter the way most people do. But I still get this like incredibly vulnerable picture of like her personality and interests and way of existing, which is probably unavoidable with any kind of comic. And maybe, you know, yeah, there's this sort of constant interplay between like wanting to be alone and then also craving a connection. And that's sort of, you know, summed up in the fact that she does have this completely controlled online persona, but her work is very honest and open and confessional and, you know, rich and detailed.
You said that the stuff had been serialized in Comics Workbook. Now,
mm-hmm.
That's Frank Santoro's Tumblr, right? Is
yeah.
that all people who have done his correspondence course?
Oh, I'm not sure about that. He has invited me to contribute to it, and I haven't done his course. Although
okay.
it is a great course, as far as I can tell. Some amazing work has come out of it. And I'm not sure, you know, the comics were fine serialized on Tumblr. Reading them on her site is like the complete experience, but it was nice to see them serialized too.
Yeah. She's, I mean, you guys are the same way, where you post a lot of stuff online and then stuff will go to print, right? It doesn't always work for every cartoonist. It works very well for her.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I have done. I didn't sort of come up like very comfortably online. Like it's sort of new to me. So like I put up work online that really does not suited to be online a lot of the time. I don't know. Do you guys have?
I'm kind of having the opposite, not problem but issue. I'm doing this webcomic written by Annie Mock that's being serialized on Hazlitt. And we decided at the start of working on that we wanted to have it in a really long scrolling format because it's about mermaids and takes place underwater. So having that like endless scroll is really suited to like, you know, feeling like you're in the ocean and there's no boundaries anywhere. But we do want to print it eventually. And okay. I basically told her like, let's just do it however we want for the web, and I'll redraw it when we make the book out of it and try and make it fit as best as possible. God. No, because, well, I mean,
not the whole thing.
No, not the whole thing, but I was really quite attached to the idea of, like, using the web format in the way that it's most optimal and really not considering, you know, the print ramifications until the time came. So and it also means that the book will be like kind of a markedly different experience, which I think is good for something that people have already read online. Like when they buy the book, it should be, you know, different or improved in some way and not just verbatim everything they read before.
Yeah. I know I train. So Hollow is a longer work that I publish occasionally online and which will eventually be a book, in 20 years or something.
You have that contract already?
Yeah, I've got it locked down.
It's due in 2025.
Right. I got a really good contract. But I know that it's been sort of a fun challenge trying to make a comic that fits in both worlds. It's because it reads as sort of a scroll comic, but then I'm trying to think in terms of the spread. So there's a lot of like these long tracking shots, and one of my rules about doing a tracking shot in a comic it just looks better if you have. Like if you're following a character walking, you can, even if the camera is moving with them, it looks really nice to have them actually moving left to right inside the panel as well. But then it gets tough if that just goes on forever because eventually they're on the edge of the page. So that's that's when I try to have them go through a door or something so that I can start them over again on the left side of the page after you turn the page and get to another spread because it's not as noticeable. And in online, that doesn't translate as well. They just sort of jump back and forth.
Oh, I see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, there's sort of questions of like flow that have different rules depending on the format. And there are like all sorts of rules that are designed to be broken or whatever. Like, what is it? The 180 rule where it's like, you don't show two people talking and then like flip them in the next panel or whatever, which I have completely like no regard for any formal rule for anything.
As long as
I think that there's a way to organize your comics so that they flow easily and sensibly. But another benefit of the comics medium is that you can do unorthodox things and have that produce a unnerving effect in the reader or create like a sense of tension and confusion. And I always err on that side. So I would say my stuff is not like traditionally formatted, but I like to break the rules, I guess.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah, that's something I admire about your work a lot.
Thank you.
The thing, I guess, with the Gigi things, like I would say, like, it's not a criticism, but it's sort of like we've said a couple times, like the way it works is that the books are vertically, like you flip them up, and I've never loved that. It feels like there's no other option. but I've never, like, it seems like that's the only solution to sort of, like, maintain the feeling of the online scroll, to have it flip sideways, but I don't know, not my favorite thing.
It's definitely...
That's not really a criticism, it's just sort of like there's sort of, it's a solution, you know, that has, like, its positives and negatives. Sorry, what were you going to say?
Well, a few things. I like the idea of, like, getting a book where you need to be kind of, like, more acutely aware of how you handle it, because it's just a different format. Yeah. And, you know, her work is so delicate, and she takes so much time with these, like, long, complicated sequences that it really makes you kind of sit up and pay attention. And she's sparse with dialogue and just incredibly focused. So you're really invited to, like, look through all the details and take your time and really feel, like, the twist of every knife as she, like, hones in on the conflict.
Yeah.
And then the other thing I was going to say is that I actually have not had the experience of reading her work on a phone or tablet, but I feel like it would probably turn out to work really well.
Oh, that tablet would be great, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I would feel like a character in one of her stories, just, like, scrolling through.
Just walking past other people, nobody ever looking at anybody.
Yeah, in my, like, beautiful blouse and skirt and
yeah.
fancy haircut.
But what's really nice about, I mean, like, as you said, like, you know, the stories are not, like, that long, but you can spend a lot of time with them, and it's also, as we sort of have just had this little talk, like, there's a lot you can get out of it, like, there's a lot in it.
Yeah, I'm always looking forward to see what she's working on next. I think that the, like, her body of work as a whole that you see on her website is just, like, so coherent, and the progression is, like, so exciting, the way she's just, like, honing her skills and going in new directions, but still maintaining this, like, really solid, for lack of a better word, brand, although I hate to use that term.
Sure.
some people say brand, other people say, like, you know, artistic identity, which is much better.
Right.
I think she's just amazing.
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. Okay. I was just going to second that. It's so exciting to see somebody getting so much better with each story. Each story is a little more complex and a little riskier, and I don't know. I really, not to say in any way that I'm not a fan of hers already, but thinking of what Gigi will be making in, like, 2020, if she's still making comics, is really exciting.
Yeah, God willing.
Great, somebody. How could she not have a book deal? How can she not?
If she hasn't been approached, then it's ridiculous.
Okay.
Oh God! I mean, like, we're like Twitter friends, and we talk occasionally. I haven't had, like, an extended conversation with her. She deserves to have every book deal she could ever want. Just my two cents.
Yeah, every book.
Well, a lot of publishers listen to the podcast. I'm sure they make it all the way to the end.
Well, I hear
your recommendation.
You better be fighting.
I think about, like, her work and how every story is, like, very specifically in its own universe, even though they all go together so well, that it would be tough to think of, like, reformatting all of them for a single book format, like a big hardcover or whatever. Right. For cartoonists who work in this way, where they switch up the format of what they do, my dream is always, like, this sort of, like, box set where it's, like, you know, a brushed aluminum case where you open it up, it's like a black velvet interior with all of these mini comics stacked up and tied with, like, a, like, pink silk bow or whatever. I think that would go with the content of her work.
Yeah.
So if any publishers are feeling, like, really ambitious to just make, like, a beautiful art object out of her output, that would be rad.
Yeah, I'd buy it.
All right, well, I think we're there. Thank you.
Cool.
It was really nice talking to you guys. Sorry,
yeah,
it
was
took
great
so
chatting.
Long. Can I ask something a bit weird?
Of course.
You guys are a little younger than me. Is it weird for me to keep saying you guys? I feel self-conscious about it. Like, I can't stop myself.
Oh.
Is that, like, a thing, like, where like people are like trying to not say that as much? Or yeah, have you not heard anything about this?
No, people are trying to not say it as much, but I think
that... I apologize if I've been saying it this whole
time. No, it's fine with me. And to be honest, I haven't like worked out a really good and suitable alternative for it yet, so I still find myself using it a lot.
Mm, yeah, I still don't feel... I feel not genuine saying folks or y'all.
Yeah. Yeah, I usually go with y'all, but it's a little bit of an affectation, so I'm self-conscious about it.
Sure. I couldn't do that. Yeah, y'all. There he is. Hey, buddy, how are you?